This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, the domestic use of military force, the iron fist behind the velvet glove, part two. It's amazing what you can find if you turn over a few rocks in the anti-terrorism legislation Congress approved during the election season. So writes Jeff Stein, the Congressional Quarterly National Security Editor, in his article December 1, 2006, Fine Print in Defense Bill Opens Door to Martial Law. Jeff Stein is referring to the law PL-109-364, signed by President Bush in a private White House signing, on October 17th, the use of armed forces in major public emergencies. This is part, it's an amendment to the little known provision of the 1807 Insurrection Act, which Congress passed in 1807 to limit the president's power to deploy troops within the United States. The amendment to the Insurrection Act was exposed by Frank Morales in an important article October 29, 2006. Frank Morales, as we mentioned over and again on Taking Aim, has made a point of studying the militarization of the police force in the United States. And Frank did, on October 29th, published an analysis, Bush Moves Towards Martial Law, about the amendment to the Insurrection Act. The closer inspection of the language shows how the alteration sets the stage for martial law. As Stein says, confirming what Morales writes, quote, the amended law takes the cuffs off. Specifically, Stein says, the new language adds, quote, natural disaster, epidemic, or other serious public health emergency, terrorist attack or incident to the list of conditions permitting the president to take over local authority. Particularly, and this is the important part of the amendment, quote, if domestic violence has occurred to such an extent that the constituted authorities of the state or possession are incapable of maintaining public order, end of quote. The significance is that the change to the notion of conspiracy with the definition of enemy combatants, who as particularly people who have purposefully and materially supported hostilities against the United States, end quote, this is language that changed with the Military Commissions Act recently signed by Congress. Recently passed by Congress and signed by the president. It subverts the long-standing posse comitatus statutes that limit the military's involvement in law enforcement, thereby making it easier for the president to declare martial law. This is the conclusion not only of Morales and Stein. Those are the exact words of Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat from Vermont, when he warned that the new amendment to the Insurrection Act virtually invites the White House to declare federal martial law. We discussed this extensively in Part 1. Today, on Part 2, we continue the discussion of domestic use of military force, and in particular, we will cite further examples of how military force has been used in the United States, particularly to quell the workers' struggle. Ralph.
Well, Maya, what the article by Jeff Stein emphasizes here is that this is not a sleight of hand. This is not just a passing fancy. What has been done here is to prepare the ground for declaring martial law on the basis of dissent, on the basis of opposition, on the basis of disaffection and mobilization on the part of the population. There's no ambiguity about this. It's an explicit, as it was stated by Stein, it was slipped into the defense bill as a rider with a little study. Yet all other congressional committees with jurisdiction over these matters paid no attention. In fact, they were not even allowed to hold hearings on the proposals as such. The section 526, which is part of the section which was tucked into the $526 billion defense bill, was pushed, as they call it, across the goal line, and that was last September. And it's interesting that the total silence was met by the Democratic Party, but also, of course, as it was put by Stein, this was pushed over the backs of the governors of the states of the country, 22 of whom are Republican, for whatever that matters. So, in other words, they have, in essence, put into place a language now that allows the mere exercise of dissent or of opposition to the government to constitute the insurrectional mode that allows for no questions asked, no permissions sought, no ambiguities and no hesitations, full-scale military rule.
Ralph, between 1807 and 1925, now this is just that period, federal troops were employed more than 100 times under the auspices of the Militia and Insurrection Acts, primarily after the Civil War when federal troops occupied the South. But aside from the use of federal troops in the occupation of the South, most of the federal intervention of troops, and this is not only the federalizing of the National Guard, but the actual sending of U.S. military federal army troops into the states and controlling the situation there. These primarily are instances of labor struggle. Above all, labor struggle.
Well, Maya, I think it's important to note. I mean, we cited last week an important article by Colonel Daniel Smith, who published a piece called Usurpation of Power, the 2007 Defense Authorization Act and the, quote, reform, unquote, of the Insurrection Act of 1807. Now, Colonel Smith, and I want to say in passing that some of the arguments and the documents and the articles that are appearing now in the Army's newspapers and in the military newspapers are extremely revealing, particularly, for example, the piece by Colonel Smith, and later we'll refer to the piece by Matt Matthews in Combat Studies Institute Press.
Ralph, Colonel Smith's he is a colonel, retired colonel, but he was writing for the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Aside from Colonel Smith, the U.S. Army War College and other avenues of the military have been publishing incredible pieces about Posse Comitatus and also the Insurrection Act.
Yes, but I think what I would like to mention about Colonel Smith is he draws upon a lifetime career in the military, and for whom he was an analyst and a historian, and he draws precisely upon that awareness of the role of the military in American history that I think would put many so-called Marxists to shame, because he has a class understanding in the way he depicts the events and the way he documents them. He writes, as we discussed last week with respect to the Whiskey Rebellion, under the 1792 Militia Act, Congress had enumerated three specific circumstances that would allow for the militia and the federal service to be called forth. And indeed, that was all put in place with the 1792 Militia Act. But at that time, they had required it to be renewed every 3 years. Is that familiar? In 1795, this requirement, along with the involvement of any supervising judge, was dropped. Again, you see that the precedents are clear, from the inception of the founding of the Republic, as it is called, those who had property and those who had power sought to emasculate the artisans and the rebels and the peasants and the business holders or artisans and workers from having any political authority or ability to assert their will. In 1799, Congress authorized the president to call out federal regulars empowered by the Militia Act and to federalize state militia to impose military control when government policies were opposed. No longer is it just a matter of insurrection. Indeed, the first Insurrection Act arising from Aaron Burr and his planning to sail down the Mississippi River and to attack Spanish New Orleans to achieve the secession of the states of the Southeast, a plan for which the entire ruling class was on board. Burr was simply precipitous, and they had intended to do this with a pretext, as they usually do. The seizure of other people's land has been a constant of U.S. history, but they always find a lying pretext, as in the 1846 seizure of Mexico and prior to that the amputation of Texas. They claim that the Mexican troops are firing on U.S. soldiers. And so with respect to the amputation of Spanish New Orleans and the Mississippi River, the plans of Burr were the plans of all the rulers, but they invoked the use of federal troops to prevent anyone but themselves from carrying out the very acts for which they were putatively using military force to intercept. We have to be clear here that, as the article by Smith points out, the Insurrection Act of 1807 amended the 1795 statute to permit the President of the United States to call forth the militia for the purpose of suppressing all acts that shall be lawful for him to employ for the same purpose such part of the land naval forces of the United States as shall be deemed or judged necessary, and the clear mandate for the invocation of arbitrary and military rule has a long and studied history in the use of power by the property-owning classes in the United States.
Ralph, the Section 334 of the Insurrection Act, which deals with presidential proclamation, ordering those engaged in opposing the government or fomenting unrest to disperse, is cited by Colonel Smith with the amendment. The 2007 law adds to this, quote, insurgents, end quote, the phrase, quote, or those obstructing the enforcement of the laws, end quote. And he states that this means that the president determines to whom the proclamation applies, and it gives him, ipso facto, the power to determine when the laws are being obstructed, regardless of the views of state authorities. Actually, we saw this happen in history. In 1854, U.S. marshals turned more often to the military to assist them in the return of fugitive slaves in the northern states. And in May 1854, in Boston, 1,600 military and police personnel formed what was then called the largest posse comitatus in the nation's history up to that time. And what they did was they prevented the citizen swell, the emergence of many people of the city of Boston who came out to prevent the return of one fugitive slave to Virginia, an escaped slave who had found freedom in the North, and in Boston, people were leading him to Canada. And 1,600 military and police, Boston police, formed this military force to prevent this. This is 1854.
Maya, let's take a moment back here to make the point, I think, emphatically. There's an article of some importance by Matt Matthews The Posse Comitatus Act and the United States Army Historical Perspective, which was published in Combat Studies Institute Press in Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. In this very long and detailed account of the history of the use of arbitrary and military force to subjugate populations that are disaffected from policies, Matthews establishes or documents the following. Having set forth the data about the Whiskey Rebellion that we recounted in our last show, he goes on to say the following. In 1799, a minor tax rebellion in eastern Pennsylvania, eerily similar to the excise revolt faced by Washington in 1794, let's understand what we're talking about here. The poor and the workers were being taxed to a point where they could no longer earn their living, largely to concentrate commerce in the hands of large, wealthy property owners and bankers. This was class war. And when the very peasants and very farmers and very artisans who were the backbone of the revolution and who had little sway and almost no say in the affairs of Washington chose to withhold their excise or tax, it was treated as insurrection. President John Adams responded, as the article states by Matthews, quote, in the same manner as Washington, with one notable exception. Unconcerned with any of the provisions in the Act of 1795, Secretary of War James McHenry now summoned the regular army units and militia force to quell the insurrection. The great Federalist desire for a strong central government and a potent standing army was at work here on behalf of those in control. And he goes on to articulate how, from that moment, from 1799 through 1806 with Aaron Burr, with the actual use of the same procedures by Jefferson and James Madison, Madison responded by informing Jefferson, it does not appear that regular troops can be deployed under legal provision, but only against expeditions. So exasperated by this perceived limitation, Jefferson requested Congress grant him the power to use the regular army without inhibition, and he signed a bill into law 5 days later, strengthening the president's authority in all cases of, quote, civil unrest, unquote. Now, civil unrest, as we've made clear, is always translated as class struggle, workers withholding their labor, farmers and artisans refusing to pay abusive and excessive taxes, organizing opposition, holding rallies, withholding their services from those who have control over them, defined as insurrection and met with military force.
Ralph, it's especially important now to refer to these changes in the Insurrection Act because of the conditions that are emerging in this country, and I think it's time to address some of them. An article by Brett Ahrens, Economic Armageddon Predicted, appeared in the Boston Herald November 23rd, 2004. And this article by Brent Ahrens that you rediscovered recently refers to Stephen Roach, the chief economist at investment banking giant Morgan Stanley. Stephen Roach was meeting a select group of fund managers, and he brought forth a prediction. And as Ahrens points out, Stephen Roach usually is very high about the economy. He thinks everything is doing well. So Ahrens was surprised when he heard that what Roach had said at this meeting. Roach's prediction, quote, America has no better than a 10% chance of avoiding economic Armageddon. The Herald had obtained a copy of Roach's presentation. And a stunned source who was at the meeting said, quote, it struck me at how extreme Roach had been, much more than he ever appears in public. Roach had seen a 30% chance of a slump occurring soon within the United States, and a 60% chance that, quote, will muddle through a while and delay the eventual Armageddon. But Armageddon is on the table.
The chances, he says, of escaping a total economic meltdown in the capitalist order is 1 in 10 in his professional estimation. The chief economist at Morgan Stanley, 1 in 10. And he stated that the trade deficit and the falling dollar and the key and the enormous acquisition of treasury bills and the resulting inflation is something from which there is no escape. He stated U.S. consumers are in debt up to their eyeballs and they will be pounded. This is not just a matter of Armageddon. It is a perfect storm. This is their language. This is not the working class militants arguing about the inevitability of the collapse of corporate capitalism. This is from within this established order, talking to each other, making calculated assessments on the basis of which they have to make their own investment decisions. To finance its current account deficit with the rest of the world, the United States has to import $2.6 billion in cash every working days. This is 80% of the entire world's net savings. Is this sustainable, he asks? No. He notes that household debt is at unprecedented levels. 20 years ago, the total debt of U.S. households was equal to half the size of the economy. Today, the figure of the debt of U.S. households is is over 85% of the national economy, and half of new mortgage borrowing is at flexible rates, which means that the borrowers are waiting to have a catastrophe. Their flexible rates are going to float right up into a catastrophe because as the rates are pushed high by the economic collapse, by the enormous indebtedness, by the valueless of the treasury bills, the impact on every person who holds a credit card debt, every person who has an automobile payment debt, every person who has a rent to pay, every person who has a mortgage to meet. Disaster, catastrophe, collapse. Now, brothers and sisters, the Armageddon, this is in the Boston Herald, economic Armageddon that Stephen Roach, the chief investment analyst and economist of Morgan Stanley, has laid forth in unmistakable detail is the genesis of the architecture of the fascist state, the predicate for arbitrary rule, the necessity for permanent war, and the reason for staged events like 9/11 to create a climate of terror, an atmosphere of fear, and a license to deprive us of the most elementary liberties that never would we even imagine ourselves accepting or passing a blind eye towards their occurrence, but for the climate of terror, the ideological construct which is the ruling class means through which martial law, military rule, and class war are imposed.
Mother Jones, May-June 2006 issue, published some documentation by Clara Jeffrey, a look at the numbers, how the rich get richer. The mythology is that capitalism affords opportunities for individuals and creates a better world. But the statistics show otherwise. She cites, in 1985, the Forbes 400 were worth $221 billion combined. Today, they're worth $1.13 trillion, more than the gross domestic product of Canada. There have been few new additions to the Forbes 400. In other words, very much the same 400 people are listed year after year. But the median household income of ordinary folks like you and me has also stagnated at around $44,000. Meanwhile, the Forbes 400 wealth has increased from $221 billion, the same 400, and they're worth today $1.13 billion.
Trillion.
In 2005, 25.7 million Americans, however, received food stamps. That's a 49% increase since 2000. So while there have been few additions to the Forbes 400, there's been a 49% increase since the year 2000 in the number of Americans receiving food stamps. Also, let's look at the federal minimum wage. Adjusted for inflation, the minimum wage has fallen 42% since its peak in 1968. What does that mean? The $5.15 hourly minimum wage, if it had risen at the same rate as CEO compensation since 1990, the minimum wage today would be $23.03. A minimum wage employee who today works 40 hours a week, and remember, many people who have minimum wage jobs have to work much more than 40 hours a week. But if they work 40 hours a week for 51 weeks a year, that means only 1 week vacation, they would take home $10,506 before taxes. The average Walmart employee earns more than the minimum wage. However, the average Walmart employee earns only $17,530 last year. That is still $1,820 below the poverty line for a family of four.
Hold that thought, Maya. You just described how that figure is way below the poverty line for a family of four. Look at what you had cited before by Clara Jeffrey with reference to the Forbes figures about the median household income at $44,000. But a median household is four people. You're talking, therefore, about $11,000 per person, brothers and sisters. Can you explain to me how anybody in the United States can live for a year on $11,000 and pay rent and buy food and purchase clothes and pay for gas and get back and forth to work? How can you do that? By debt. By increasing the amount of credit card debt that you have at 18% and then compounded interest. In other words, it is a magnification of the indebtedness of every one of us and the total indebtedness of the society at large in an extraordinary house of cards, a colossal hat trick that cannot but collapse. That is what drives this engine of repression forward. Have no doubt about this. The history we've described and the reality we're now discussing is what underlines the class meaning of repressive legislation. It's what informs the architecture of the fascist state because it is class war. It is class war. It is class war. It is the ruling class, this tiny oligarchy, frightened and terrified at the inevitable prospect of what they call insurrection. From their lips to God's ear. Insurrection indeed. But what they mean by insurrection is dissent. What they mean by insurrection is unlawful combination. Two or more people getting together and deciding to do something together in opposition to official policy. Be clear, brothers and sisters, the facade is only a facade, and beneath it you have the mailed fist, the iron fist, the fist of repression, exploitation, subjugation, and class war.
And Ralph, let's look again at that median household income at $44,000, which means half the population makes above it and half below. Walmart is the largest private employer in the United States. And with the average Walmart employee earning $17,530, that's $26,500 less, more than half the median income of the United States. What does this mean? It's been published time and again that one out of three black youth, one out of three black youth is either in prison, on probation, or on parole. And an article, July 10th, 2001, by Vince Beiser, again from Mother Jones, How We Got to 2 Million, meaning 2 million people imprisoned in the United States, he asks, how did the land of the free become the world's leading jailer? What's important in relation to what we're talking about, an economic disparity and also the changes in the Insurrection Act, has to do with the focus that Beiser makes with the city of Los Angeles, the large metropolitan city of Los Angeles. He points out that local taxpayers in Los Angeles spent nearly $400 million to build Twin Towers, not the World Trade Center Twin Towers, but Twin Tower Correctional Facility, the world's biggest jail. It was built in the early 1990s because the older jails were overflowing. And each day in Los Angeles, as many as 6,000 prisoners pass through the IRC's vast labyrinth of hallways and holding areas. It takes a staff, he writes, of 800 just to log, sort, and monitor them, from booking and fingerprinting to locking them up in cells crowded with other inmates. California taxpayers, not just Los Angeles taxpayers, spent nearly $5.3 billion to build new lockups throughout the state. 21 new prisons in the state built since 1980, and the growth of new prisons is still going on. Another $4.8 billion every year to keep them running. He states, the United States now locks up some 2 million people. While the nation's population has grown by only 20% in the last 20 years, the number of Americans held in local, state, and federal lockups has doubled and then doubled again, and the number is still growing. But he asks, why is the prison population growing so fast? And why is the bill for prisons grown six times faster per capita than spending on higher education, which has actually dropped or remained stagnant in many states? Why is this happening when nationwide the crime rates today are comparable to those of the 1970s, but the incarceration rate is four times higher than it was then? It's not the crime, he states, that's increased. It's the punishment.
Maya, this is a clear example of what we've often documented and called the war on Black America. Male youth, as the Urban League has documented in its own report, are an endangered species in the United States, and that is by design. It is not just the dying inner cities where there is no work. It is not just the locations in which drugs are pumped in from the Central Intelligence Agency and the Drug Enforcement Agency in every inner city in the United States, in a virtual flood of drug traffic that is hugely profiteering, but is also the means through which the youth, who are on the very lowest end of the little hustle, are constantly put into prison with the key thrown away.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Domestic Use of Military Force, The Iron Fist Behind the Velvet Glove, Part 2.
War was declared upon Black America for a very long time, but in particular in the aftermath of the Civil Rights Movement, with the struggles that arose out of the 1960s, aborted by the execution of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and the all-out call-out of troops to meet every response of the oppressed Black population to the occupying army known as the police. Bear in mind that when we speak of military rule, what do you think daily life is for? Like for the Black and Latino inhabitants of our inner cities. These are occupied territories with counterinsurgency forces. John F. Kennedy is the president who introduced SWAT teams and declared as the policy with Warren, Christopher, and Watts to impose the counterinsurgency modalities of Vietnam on the cities of the United States. All of the SWAT gear, these are now shock troops, combat troops, death squads in uniform that operate across the cities of the United States, and that's their function. Indeed, what we have here with the 2 million, and that's counting, of in our prisons is a system of slavery. How do I come to that conclusion? Because people are getting $20 a month, because people are being charged in prison for their toilet paper, for their cosmetics. They're being charged for their underwear. They're being charged for every aspect of their lives. If they want to purchase something, they have to pay a one-third surplus to the prison. If they want to purchase something from the commissary, it's dependent upon exploitation while they're being paid what are not even callable starvation wages. When they have to go to visit their families at funerals, if they're allowed to, they are charged hundreds of dollars for the cost of the guards being sent with them. When a prisoner is released from prison, and if he's picked up by the authorities and put in the county jail on a false charge, he's charged for his incarceration in that county jail, whether he's convicted of anything or not. Every penny is taken out of the pocket of the person who's detained, and nothing is returned to that person. What do we have here? We have a slave system, brothers and sisters. What's the modality through which it is achieved? It is targeting the black population of the United States for a war, a class war, a war that is designed to drive down their standards of living and their income capacities and to make a permanent underclass of this population. And what is the concomitant of that? In prison, as the New Jersey Star-Ledger has documented, prison military gear factories take flak. Thousands of federal prison inmates are working overtime, filling Pentagon contracts for everything from radio components to body armor. The inmates for Federal Prison Industries, a subsidiary that does work for a private outfit called Unicor, sold almost $1 billion worth of goods to the federal government last year. What do you think that's based upon? It's based on $20 a month, brothers and sisters. It's based on wages that make the minimum wage look like a gratuity. What we're dealing with here is a slave system, and that's the nature of capitalism. We will address it on a global scale, but within the frontiers of the United States, the repressive apparatus is directly related to exploitation, to the racist war on black youth. Military gear, it's Pentagon Inc. And as Michael Manch, the president of Ashland Sales and Service, the formal clothing, the clothing manufacturer in suburban Philadelphia that supplies uniforms to the Pentagon, made clear everybody's being put out of business because the feds are going to the prisons. The Pentagon and the military that we're describing here is linked like the lips to the teeth to the prison system in the United States to put the poor away, to subjugate the blacks to slave conditions and to wage and counterinsurgency war within every inner city frontier. We in the United States talk about the prospects of military rule and the abrogation of our formal rights. The poor and the black and the youth live that totalitarian existence every waking day of their lives, brothers and sisters. It's in reality, it's in practice, it's not in formal documents. The documents, they are the last things to be shredded. The first are our practical rights on the ground.
Ralph, I refer our brothers and sisters to our three-part series, Buried Alive, which is available on our internet and in CD form from us at Taking Aim. Aside from the repression, the subjugation of black America, we have the attacks from the result of economic Armageddon, the class struggle, the struggle against the working population, as well as the racist struggle against black workers.
Which is part of the same subset, because racist exploitation and subjugation are the very essence of class control. It's pitting us against each other while we weaken and attack the most vulnerable among us.
I had mentioned before that the primary use of military force, aside from the occupation of the South during the Civil and the aftermath of the Civil War, has been the suppression of worker struggle, in particular mass strikes. Let's look at the first great upheaval, and I want to devote some time today on Taking Aim to the insurrection of July 1877. It was the first great American mass strike, and at the time it was reviewed as a violent rebellion. The participants in the 1877 rail strike and in the coal mining strikes that preceded it were considered terrorists, and federal military force was called out, as well as National Guard, as well as private security forces such as the Pinkerton. Look at the New York Times, July 25th, 1877. Chicago in possession of communists. The New York Tribune, July 28th, 1877. Communists in Chicago, 13 killed. July 22nd, 1877, the New York World. Pittsburgh sacked, the city completely in power of devilish spirit of communism. In 1873, on September 18th, the collapse of the banking house of J. Cook and Company on 3rd Street in Philadelphia precipitated a depression, a cyclical depression of industrial society. By 1877, there were as many as 3 million unemployed, estimated at the time to be one-fifth, 20% of the working force. And it was estimated that they would never again be on a payroll. Two-fifths of those employed were working no more than 6 to 7 months a year, and less than one-fifth, that's one in five people, was regularly working. The wages of those employed had been cut as much as 45%. They were earning almost half of what they had been working for a little while before. They were often earning no more than a dollar a day. Of the 30 national trade unions that had been organized when that depression, the Depression of 1873, began, only 8 or 9 remained by 1877. Lockouts, blacklists, conspiracy charges, and loyalty oaths of the day were yellow dog contracts in which employees were forced to swear they would never join a union became the dominant way of operating. A trade union member in the United States was hunted like a mad dog, according to a French trade unionist. This was their comment in 1876. Trade unions were secret societies with passwords and recognition signals, and they started to form once again. The newspapers talked about tramps and stated that people were hungry because they couldn't find work, but work wasn't available. By 1877, it had reached a culminating point. And before that, in the coal mine areas of 1874, 1875, there were textile and coal strikes throughout the anthracite region with the growing organization primarily of Irish in their trade union, the Working Men's Benevolent Association. Ralph?
Maya, by 1877, there were 3 million unemployed, one-fifth of the nation's workforce, and indeed the two-fifths of those employed were working for 6 months a year at one-fifth of the regular working wage. And the wages had been cut by 45%. They were under a dollar a day. You have an all-out intensified war against the railroad workers and the coal miners and the thousands of miles of railroads and the countless mills and factories and the mines and forges. All the wealth that was vast wealth created by labor had left the working population in desperate straits, total poverty and systemic disease, lung disease, and the textile and coal mine coal strikes in 1874 and 1875 began the preparations for the use of what? Of martial law. And that indeed is the template of what would unfold. The banker, Gowans, who had reached his fame, having reached his greatest height during the Depression of 1873, when as head of the country's first effective coal trust, as well as of the Philadelphia and Reading Railroad, he charged that a Workingmen's Benevolent Association, which had been organized by some Pennsylvania anthracite miners, was, quote, a foreign conspiracy to overthrow society by force and violence. And indeed, the men were put on trial, shattering the union, resulting in the execution, imprisonment, and banishment of all its leaders. In fact, the story in, with this fatal ending had begun in 1869. When the whistle atop the colliery at the Avondale mine in Pennsylvania's Lucerne County sent out a sharp, repeated blast, denoting an accident, and all the miners living on a long street facing the mine entry and their wives and their children were running towards the mine shaft. 179 men were in the bowels of the earth, and they were choking and blinded, and they were killed to the last man. Thousands of miners were gathering around the fatal shaft, said a New York Tribune headline on September 8th. And indeed, the families were begging rescue teams, begging them. The men were left for dead. 179 within 2 days were brought out dead. An Irish John Siney, the head of the Working Men's Benevolent Association, got on the wagon. His face contorted with grief. As thousands of miners crowded around, and in the hush, broken only by the sound of weeping, could be heard the noises of the bodies being carried. And Siney said, "Men, if you must die with your boots on, then die for your families and your homes. We do not longer consent to die like rats in a trap, who those who have no more interest in us than the pick with which we dig." The Working Men's Benevolent Association, formed the year before, went on strike for an 8-hour day. And what was the response? Martial law, the use of troops, the slaughter of the men.
And, Ralph, it also, the execution of 19 miners. The courts were used, and these miners were falsely accused of the murder of Benjamin Yost, a patrolman in the mining community of Tamaqua. And the prime witness was the very man who had murdered Benjamin Yost, and his wife even testified that he had been the murderer. But the 19 coal miners who had stood up in defense of their families and in defense of other miners were executed. They were hanged, and the courts were used. But the first nationwide strike, in U.S. history, broke out some years later, and this was the railway strike of 1877. It spread from state to state and city to city, from West Virginia to Kentucky and Ohio, from New York to Chicago, from St. Louis to San Francisco. As the strike was broken in one place, writes the authors of Labor's Untold Story, Richard Boyer and Herbert Murray, as the strike was broken in one place, it appeared in another. American troops fired on American working men as regiments under General Phil Sheridan were recalled from fighting the Sioux and were thrown against the workers of Chicago. There was the Battle of the Roundhouse in Pittsburgh, bloody street fighting between troops and workers in Baltimore, and skirmishes the country over in which scores of workers were killed and hundreds wounded. From the first day of the strike, and this is important to note, the press declared it was a communist conspiracy to overthrow the government by force and violence. It was not. It was the Depression exploding. 4 years of humiliation, joblessness, and hunger erupting in struggle. Children were killed by U.S. Army troops in Pittsburgh and elsewhere as children fought alongside their parents, fought the militia. Farmers came trooping in from the countryside to help the strikers, whose ranks were swollen by the unemployed, by the coal miners, the mill workers, by all the thousands whose lives had been made uncertain and bitter by the Depression. The strike began on Monday, July 16th, 1877, when 40 firemen and brakemen quit outside, who worked for the Baltimore and Oreo Railroad, quit over the working conditions. And it spread to the little railroad town of Martinsburg, West Virginia. On that day, the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad cut wages 10%, the second cut in 8 months. In Martinsburg, the men gathered around the railroad road yards, talking and waiting throughout the day. And toward evening, a crew of the cattle train fed up abandoned the train. As Ralph always says, it only takes that spark of a few workers stopping work, and then others galvanized by their action join them. And this is what happened in 1877, and other trainmen refused to replace the workers who had abandoned the train. By the end, 1,200 seized the depot. 1,200 brakemen and firemen, because remember, railroads were the primary long transportation of the day. It wasn't trucks at the time. It was railroads, and railroads crisscrossed the country, bringing freight, bringing people. And what's interesting about this great strike of 1877 is that the rail workers made sure that people were able to travel. What they stopped was the freight of the capitalist producers. Ralph.
The great strike of 1877 was prepared for and preceded by the anthracite coal struggles with the Molly Maguires and the Association of Hibernians, infiltrated by the Pinkertons. But we have to be, what you had here was a series of essential death squads, because as the study by Peter Roberts in his Anthracite Coal Communities establishes, the owners furnished arms to their foremen. Whenever labor sought relief, it was answered with the pointing of a revolver. Miners disappeared, their bodies found later in deserted mine shafts. There were effective death squads that were put into force, and many of these were, in fact, government agents, not just Pinkerton agents. And what was done was systematically to kill the militants. By militants, it was meant anybody who called for defending an 8-hour day or for asking for a living wage or for having some safety measures introduced into the mines. And these are the antecedent events to the 1877. And the 1877 was characterized by the essential ingredients that we've described here: a relentless use of goons and death squads in the workplace, the utilization within the railroads themselves of armed thugs who murdered anyone who spoke up or spoke out. And then, indeed, when the workers would come out and strike, or would stand firm against the repression, they were labeled something in particular by both the authorities and the New York Times. They were labeled terrorists. The category of terror had never been so frequently invoked as it was in 1877 against the railroad strikers, against those who sought to withstand the death squad operations of the bosses. Tom Scott, head of the Pennsylvania Railroad, which moved 31 million tons of freight and had net earnings of $22 million during a depression year, had in fact made the decision, or to put it correctly, he had simply purchased the president, Rutherford B. Hayes, during a tight election with Samuel J. Tilden. And having obtained his control, with his control as well over the Texas and Pacific Railroad, and his determination to use the military in his dealings with all of the railroad workers, Scott proceeded to have Hayes mobilize the militia and declare martial law. And indeed, with the response of the workers in the form of a general strike, the first nationwide strike in history, which broke out on the railroads, a strike which spread from state to state, from city to city, from West Virginia to Kentucky and Ohio and New York to Chicago and St. Louis and San Francisco. As fast as the strike was broken, it appeared in another, and American troops were used. General Phil Sheridan was called from fighting, as you said, of the Sioux, and a generalized onslaught was unleashed against the communist conspiracy, the terrorists of working people, who were in fact being met by the martial law that has been prepared by our rulers from the inception of this republic, that is indeed what is being prepared for us today. When we speak about martial law as imminent, it's in relation to the Armageddon of economic collapse in the United States, brothers and sisters. It is a long history. It is a continuing struggle. And the story is yet to be told.
Ralph, 1877 is the most significant because of it, the beginning. It is from 1877 and strike after strike that federal troops were called out. The domestic use of military force, the iron fist behind the velvet glove in support of the capitalist state power. Capitalism in conjunction with the legislators they put into place to do their bidding. The iron fist behind the velvet glove. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Domestic Use of Military Force, The Iron Fist Behind the Velvet Glove, Part 2, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com, and also on the WBAA archive. This program was recorded Tuesday, December 12th, 2006. Please contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net. That's takingaim@pacbell.net. We'll be with you next week.